Our world has become complex and disruptive, and leading teams and organizations takes courage, determination, and skill. This podcast connects you to some of the great leaders to find out just how they do it. You're listening to Russell Boyce and Daryl Crook in conversation with standout leadership in a world of disruption.
Everyone, welcome to this edition of our podcast, in which I am delighted to introduce to you Professor Eleanor Huntington. Apart from being a celebrated quantum physicist and an executive director of Australia's leading research institution, the CSIRO, Eleanor is a consummate strategist and highly experienced leader, and I've watched her career unfold since her PhD days. Eleanor, it's great to have you. Why don't you tell us about yourself? And tell us a little bit about the professional environment that you live in.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a very great pleasure and an honour. So my name is Eleanor Huntington. As Russ said, I am the Executive Director for Digital National Facilities and Collections at CSIRO. And I think the place to start is to say that I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. And in fact, I never have. And as a kid, I was constantly perplexed when grown-ups asked me that question. And I made up all sorts of ideas as a way of engaging in the conversation, including professing an undying aspiration to be a genetic engineer, an accountant, an astronaut. And of all of those, the only one that was actually true was the astronaut. And the thing that I think I was unconsciously reaching for was the thing that I was good at, which was science and maths and that sort of thing. But I didn't really know what I wanted to be. And looking back on it now as an adult, if I'd been asked a different question, I would have known the answer to the question. The question I would have known the answer to is, what do you want to do when you grow up? And the thing that is, I'm really clear on that now. I like to make a positive difference, and I like to make a difference using the skills that I've got now. And the thing I think that has characterized my journey as an adult, including my career, has been looking for the opportunities to have a positive impact on a larger and larger stage. So that's kind of what's propelled me forward. And it started from skills at science and maths, and it's kind of grown from there. In terms of the context in which I operate now, so I work in Australia's National Science Agency. I've had a very large number of years between the days when people were asking me as a kid what I want to be it's a tremendous privilege to be part of an organization that is entirely purpose-driven. That's one of the things that really compels me, and I find that really compelling. And as an organisation that is considered to be, it's a century-old jewel in the national crown. And that means that, I take quite seriously my responsibilities as the current custodian and one of many custodians. The thing about working in purpose-driven organisations is that you do indeed get to make a positive difference on a grand stage. And for me personally, that is much more that these days than my scientific and engineering skills, but obviously that plays a part in it. So I think I'll leave it there and we can kind of let the conversation unfold from there.
Eleanor, you sort of strike me already as someone I could sit and listen to for another couple of hours about this. I think you jumped many years there of all of your work in academia, and you were based, which universities were you at there, Eleanor, over the years before this?
Okay, so that journey. So I came to adulthood during the last recession that Australia had, and the unemployment for people under 25 was running sort of in the 30%.
Wow.
And so the choices for me at the time were somewhat precarious work or do a PhD. So I chose the PhD. So Russell said that he's been keeping an eye on my career since my PhD days. I did not ever actually have a particular aspiration to do a PhD. It's just kind of life took me in that direction. And when I finished my PhD, I was quite clear that in my own head that what I wanted to do was not go into academia. So imagine my surprise having spent 25 years in academia. And I left the university sector and got a job in what was in those days the Defence Science and Technology Organisation. And I was recently, a couple of years ago, in fact, I was interviewed for a series of conversations called The Year That Changed Me. And I chose the year that I worked in DSTO as the year that changed me because, like, it was profoundly transformative to have the opportunity to work with people who just lived and worked in a bigger world than the one that I had come from. So for them, science, technology, those sorts of insights were like they were a part of their world, but they were only a very narrow slice of their world. And to come to understand that after having spent so many years being really deeply embedded in the profession of research, and particularly scientific research, it was transformative to really understand that other people just lived in totally different worlds to mine and much bigger worlds than mine. And I think I've carried that with me ever since. So after working in DSTO, I then moved to the University of New South Wales on the Defence Force Academy campus and got to continue to do the things that have impelled me all the way through. So I got to advance the frontiers of knowledge in quantum computing. I got to influence the minds of the next generation. And, education is it's such a powerful and important thing, and to have the opportunity to educate in the end a very significant percentage of Australia's uniformed engineers is like that's an amazing privilege as well, kept on having conversations with my a range of bosses about all of the ways that I thought that things could get better, and to their everlasting credit, they would just keep saying, "Well, that's a great idea. Why don't you fix that?" and so I did, had a leadership journey as through the practice of leadership through those experiences, became the head of the School of Engineering and Information Technology there. And then moved over to the ANU, the Australian National University, as the Dean of Engineering and Computer Science, and spent 7 amazing years there thinking through other ways and different ways that the combined skills of science, technology, engineering and maths as applied to big complicated problems might go, and found myself riding the roller coaster of what it meant to be in the university sector and in leadership roles in the university sector during the COVID pandemic, and through the Black Summer that led into that. And now finally, well, not finally, but for I'm now at the CSIRO. And so every one of those jobs has stretched me in particular ways. Every one of those jobs, I've always tried to find a different me as part of that, as well as to have a positive impact on the environment around me. And every one of those, interestingly, I've kind of ended up moving back towards, okay, there's a bigger world here. And what is that bigger world, and how is our slice of that playing an important and influential part of that, but trying to understand other people's worlds and how we might move forward together.
Eleanor, you mentioned the word custodian when you were talking about your current role, but actually you've been a custodian and a steward all the way through, it seems to me, just listening to you talk about the young people that you've taught, you've educated, you've led people in teams, and you've demonstrated, by the sound of it, very, very strongly that desire to stretch and grow yourself. You've done that in the world of science and technology, and science technology is typically what we think of when we use the word disruption, right? At least in the business world, but disruption comes from all sorts of areas. So you also mentioned COVID. You've seen a fair bit of disruption then. Tell us, what has that look like to you? Maybe tell us the number one, what's the biggest disruptive challenge that's hit you and you've had to grapple with?
That's an interesting question. So I guess my take would be that there are a lot of forces, external forces at play on an organization or a collection of people or on an individual. And oftentimes you can predict how those forces are going to unfold. My observation over many years is that we as human beings are really good at spotting and reacting to fast moving changes. We're not so great at slow moving ones. But really disruptive stuff happens when a couple of those forces collide. That's been my observation. So, you know, you can talk about, teleport ourselves back in time 3 or 4 years ago, and we were talking about things like, well, so there's, what are the forces at play? There's climate change, there's urbanization, there's software is eating the world, there's massive population growth of human beings, there's forces in economic forces that are increasing inequality. You know, you can talk about a lot of those forces. But when they start to collide, that's when unexpected things happen, and that's when really disruptive stuff happens. So, I mean, you know, you can sensibly ask the question also, why are new zoonotic diseases emerging with increasing frequency? It's because of population pressure. It's because of mass urbanization. It's because of the fact that human beings can now travel the planet incredibly quickly. So when zoonotic diseases are created, then they spread really quickly. So and then you know, a pandemic comes along, and that accelerates things like supply chain challenges. It accelerates things like economic problems. We discover that the whole planet actually turns out to be completely interconnected, and then that starts to die away, and then, you know, more climate change forces come into play. So the thing that the disruptions that I would argue that the disruptions that we frequently experience are the ones that come when multiple forces collide. And the one thing that you can expect is that it's not going to just manifest in one particular place. I would contend that over the last 25 years, the research domain in which I have been operating, my colleagues and I have been working on quantum computing for, well, longer than I've been in the field, but there's every possibility that we're going to have a significant disruptive effect, not just on the nature of computing and communications, but also on elements of the world economy and the world security. And it's only going to be disruptive if actually a few of those forces collide at the same time. Otherwise, it's just going to be a kind of continuous change. So for me personally, certainly the last couple of years have been really quite a bouncy ride, I think it's fair to say. We've all learned a lot over the last few years, and certainly, and that includes me.
So Eleanor, let's do some quick learning then right now, because when those disruptive forces come, if you're not totally on your game, and even if you are on your game, strategy goes out the window. Daryl has been drumming into me for years now the mantra that culture eats strategy for breakfast. And I have found in my own moments of facing disruption, if the culture's good, you stand a chance. If it's not, you don't. How do you address that? How do you ensure culture that can withstand disruption as a leader? How do you do that?
So certainly the experience that we had during the last few years was that if you are formulating strategic objectives based on a reasonably sound understanding of what's going on in the outside world, what your comparative place in that landscape might look like. And based on your understanding about, you know, again, a well-formulated understanding internally about what your strengths are and where you might be able to go and what your distinctive advantage is, that puts you in so much of a better position to be able then to adapt to significant and fast-moving changes, because you've kind of got all of that information loaded up and you can start to make quality decisions that way. If you are caught napping and not being across those external and internal drivers, then all you can do is be in reactive mode. And it makes it really difficult to learn those things when everybody is stressed, tired, uncertain, and casting around. So, you know, the intellectual side of that is being across all of that and being able to adapt as you go. And in fact, one of my mentors, a chap called Brendan Sargent, wrote and spoke frequently about the concept of strategic imagination and what that means. And that I have found to be a really nice way of framing up ways of talking and thinking about them. And to the question about culture, if your understanding of the internal dynamics and the culture of the place is reasonably sound, then that means that when you have to make those decisions in a hurry, then you've got all of that loaded up and ready to go, loaded up in your brain and in your RAM, and you're ready to go when you have to make those decisions. And certainly one of the things that I learned over the last couple of years was, you know, the old narrative that leadership is about decision-making under uncertainty kind of got thrown out the window a bit. And a lot of the time, actually, leadership was about creating certainty and actually just making decisions that created certainty. And certainly one of the things that I tried to keep in my head as I was not just making decisions but also trying to lead people through times of significant disruption was finding ways to give other people, the people that I was meant to be leading, helping them to look at the landscape around them as well, and look at helping them to understand what are the things that they should be looking for so that they can regain some sense of agency themselves and make their own decisions and watch for particular changes.
Eleanor, can I just pick up on that and just take it a little bit of a step further? Our listeners at the moment are being drawn from young up-and-coming folks who really want to get their head around leadership and how we do that. I was talking to a young lady recently. She said we go to all these wonderful universities and we learn all of these things and we get a degree in this and a degree in that, but you can't kind of get a degree in leadership. And she asked me the question, you know, how do you learn something that you can't get a degree in? And I found that while it was such an important question in her mind, it's a question or an issue that we sometimes overlook. And our leaders, our listeners are from those young folks trying to get their head around leadership all the way through to senior executives and board chairs who really want to fine tune and reconfirm some of their leadership styles. So I think the question for me on my mind, Eleanor, is how has your leadership style evolved over the years? And what were some of those either pain points or key issues that created the momentum of that development of your leadership?
I mentioned it earlier that my leadership journey was facilitated, sometimes accelerated by my good fortune in terms of having amazing bosses. And one of the things that they have all done has been when an overly enthusiastic, excessively bright young person came to them and said, well, so I think, you know, I think this needs to be fixed. It's not working properly. Here are all of the ways that it could get better. Their answers were invariably, that's great, Eleanor. Off you go, have a crack. And of course, supported me through that journey. And so that just led to a series of experiences where I was given the opportunity to tackle problems of increasing complexity, where I was able to sort of slowly build my people skill set as I went. And the kinds of skills, you know, you start off with the kinds of skills in terms of consulting with people, listening to them, understanding their perspectives, learning how to, on a small scale, how to then go back and provide feedback to people once you've made a decision, engage them in decision making, learn all of those kind of skills. I think it's fair to say that at that point in my career, it was trial and error. It wasn't, and it was, you know, experimental technique and learning on the job. And at that kind of scale, as long as you've got a decent EQ and you're willing to be reflective and learn and occasionally pick yourself back up and dust yourself off and go back again, that's enough. And there came a moment in my career when the university made the decision to go through a restructure and create a school that was really very large by the university's standards. And the new head of school designate was trying to put his leadership team together, and he approached me to be one of his deputies, and I said no. It didn't feel like the right time in my career. There were a bunch of other things, so I just said no. So he got his boss to ring me and ask me if I would do it, and I said no. And he got his boss to ring me and ask me if I would do it, and I said no. And he got his boss to ring me and tell me that I was going to do it, and I went, oh, okay, fine. So I then went to the head of school designate and said, well, so I just, it can't be done the way that I have done these types of jobs previously. I just don't know how I'm going to make it work. And he said, and to his everlasting credit, he said, okay, that's fine, figure out a way to make it work. And then he supported me to make that happen. So that was kind of how I got my feet on the sort of leadership at scale treadmill. And it was the first time that I was taking on a leadership role of a group of people who didn't actually, like, I kind of hadn't in a career sense grown up with. So I didn't know them. They didn't know me. That head of school did such a great job. He was promoted out of the job in less than 18 months. And I ended up in the head of school role very young. And I think it's fair to say that I was absolutely, I didn't understand why everyone else thought I could do the job. I really didn't. And one of the great things about the university that I was working for was that they had tremendous support for the heads of school in terms of their leadership skills. And so I took all of the support I could get. And one piece of support was an executive coach. And I spent some time talking with her about it. And what she, and I'm paraphrasing somewhat, she eventually said, look, Eleanor, you do need to go out and find out why everyone else thinks you can do it, because it's part of your learning journey. But for now, suck it up and just trust that they're right and get on with it. And that was incredibly, that was another one of those transformative moments, because it was incredibly freeing to just say, okay, well, whatever it is you're doing, trust it, and maybe even trust that people outside your own head can see you better than you can see yourself. So that allowed me to relax into that, because it was the first time I'd kind of been on such a, I felt that I had been on such a public stage. But the other thing that it did was it put my feet on the path of actually being structured about learning about leadership. And so it wasn't just the usual stuff in terms of doing 360 degree reviews and all of that sort of stuff. I actually started learning about people and about people at scale and what that meant. And that was a serious turning point in my career, because for somebody who, you know, grew up thinking that science and maths was it and that was all it was, turns out people are interesting. Who knew?
Eleanor, for my I guess, career myself as a management consultant and as an executive coach, I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, you know, please, and let me send a message out to all of our listeners, take stock of what Eleanor is saying here. You know, you're hearing things like, learn as you go, have a go. You're hearing things like having high learning agility. You know, take the feedback from a coach, from your manager, and adapt as you go and as you grow. And we're learning things about, making sure you've got some of that support. In each of your stories, that person was saying, or those people were saying, we've got your back, have a go, back yourself. And I think for so many people, they're a little bit hesitant. And this whole notion of leadership, particularly leading through a lot of disruption, can scare the bejeebus out of people. And yet, why not you? If you have the passion and the emotional intelligence you also hit on before, and thank you for that. And to know what, to work out what you don't know, to develop. For you, it was taking a keen interest in those people skills and realizing that developing those and rebalancing those with your enormous technology and science and maths skills that you have to get that perfect blend and that perfect balance. Was there a moment for you where you had a bit of a wake-up call, a bit of a, oh dear, that was disastrous, but learnt from it? I'm sure, like all good leaders, there was a few to choose from. What one comes to your mind, Eleanor?
Single one. You want a single one? I'm not sure that there is a single
well,
one.
You know, rattle off two or three if you need.
Oh, look, I guess the reason I say is there a single one? It's because actually, most of the time, the things that you try don't work, or at least they don't play. No, that's not the right way to put it. So they don't play out the way that you expected.
Yeah.
And there are times when indeed, you can have these moments either on the small scale or on a grand stage where like it just doesn't go well. And for me, you know, particularly that first leadership, like significant leadership role as a head of school, that was a 4-year transformative experience. I don't know that there was ever a single moment there. It was just that new things came at me and the need for new skills came at me so quickly that I was just constantly learning. And I guess the one where like, if I was to pick one where things kind of clicked over into another place, it would be I've never been naturally good at difficult conversations. So for a long time when I had to have them, I either went too gently and people didn't even know that we were having a difficult conversation, or I went too hard and it wasn't a conversation. It was a series of this. And you now I need you to do that. And again, my coach, who worked out the way my brain works pretty quickly because that's what coaches do, gave me a book to read. And it's called Crucial Conversations. And so that book, Crucial Conversations, which is something that many coaches give to their coachees, was kind of transformative for me in a couple of respects, one of which was that obviously it helped me to get better at the practice of having those kinds of difficult conversations. And so, you know, that becomes an acquired skill that eventually becomes a reflex, and so you don't need to think so hard about it. But more importantly for me, in terms of really transforming my personal approach to leadership, was that it opened a world for me in terms of understanding that actually there's a body of literature out there that can help you, so that you don't have to just attempt to experiment with yourself and with other people. You can actually learn from a body of research. And, you know, there are social scientists out there, there are philosophers, there are ethicists, there are anthropologists, there are sociologists who think about this and who have been thinking about this as a research area for many, many, many decades, hundreds of years. And so that really helped me in terms of actually going out and learning about that literature in advance, so that I don't have to experiment on myself or other people at small or large scale in my leadership journey.
And Eleanor, some of the literature out there is also based on the personal experience of the authors. I had a boss who must have had a premonition that disruption might have been coming, and he made me read a book called The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz. And sure enough, along came disruption, and I had to apply the learnings of chapter whatever in The Hard Thing About Hard Things and lay a lot of people off, which was just about the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life, particularly when some of them were friends. But I had to do it. You must have had to go through similar experiences. Can you tell us about that as a leader? How do you deal with that?
Sure. And like I said, understanding that other people have thought hard about this is like that. That's a really powerful thing. And so for me, I have discovered that I can see into the future a little bit. And so I too could see that difficult things would be coming at us and would be coming at us quickly. And so I started seeking out some insights around decision-making in particularly contested environments. And so it turns out that there are kind of three bodies of knowledge, three ways of thinking about ethical decision-making, so three ethical schools of thought. And one of them speaks to essentially what are the consequences of the decision that you're about to make or need to make. Another one is what is your responsibility in these circumstances? And another one is how does this accord with the way that we would like to think that things are done around here? And when I was talking with a series of applied ethicists, and one in particular suggested that when you're talking to a large group of people, because, you know, these days, in the end, I have decision-making responsibility for a very large number of people. And when you're, he was talking about that in the context of when you're talking with large groups of people, you should be aware that different people kind of just intrinsically and sometimes unconsciously prioritize one of those three ways of thinking about a particular ethical decision. So when you're talking to large groups of people, you should touch on a decision from all each one of those three directions. But the thing that I found particularly powerful was, in fact, whenever I had to make some ethical decisions or highly contested decisions, and I too had to make some really, really hard ones, particularly during the pandemic because of the economic consequences on universities, I found it really powerful to actually come at each one of those questions from each of those three directions, because it gives you a rounded perspective on the decision that you're about to make. So it's not just about communications, it's actually about sort of testing the robustness of your thinking. And I found that really powerful when I was having to make the kinds of tough decisions that you're talking about, Russell, where you just have to let people go. And to be really clear with people about the why. And again, you know, I did some reading about what happens when you make some research reading about what happens when you make redundancy decisions in large organizations and what are the consequences of that, and how you can try to think about it and communicate it and do it in such a way that you create as much psychological safety for the people who are leaving as well as the people who are staying. But again, the repeating theme here is go out, find the research literature, don't just kind of make it up. And certainly that ethical decision-making question, one of the things that I have found, particularly as I have gotten into more and more senior roles, it turns out that sometimes it's almost a coin toss in terms of the consequences and the responsibilities side of the question, and it comes down to how does this decision accord with the way that we would like to think things are done around here? And certainly for me personally, the thing that I have become more and more aware of is that, like, when you're talking really about leadership, not about management, when you're talking really about leadership, so much of the time you are making tough decisions with limited information and in a time-constrained way. And that oftentimes comes down to being really clear that actually I'm making a judgment call about ethics right now. I'm making a judgment call about the way that we would like to think that we do things around here.
Eleanor, you just separated or you just touched on management and leadership. Some of our listeners will be sitting there thinking, well hold on, management and leadership, aren't they the same thing? For me, I know they are very different things. I suspect that you just touched on the fact that, yes, they are quite different sets of competencies. Can you just expand on your view of the difference between management and leadership and some examples of both, perhaps, just for our listeners' point of view as they sort of get that clear in their mind?
Sure. So, look, you know, everybody has their own definition of it, and I don't want to reprise all of the literature as well as all of the self-help book stuff that you can find on the internet about the difference between leadership and management. And I guess one of the things that I would point out is that, in fact, it's rare to find effective long-term leadership in the absence of good management skills as well, because, in fact, you know, most of the surveys show that in all of the hero leader narratives aside, most of the time what people value in their leaders is competence as much as anything else. So we'll just set that aside and we can have a whole other conversation about that. But, you know, my take would be that management is about the usual stuff in terms of managing resources, achieving deadlines, setting milestones, hitting KPIs, setting up systems that achieve that effectively, all of that sort of stuff. And it ranges from management of yourself, management of your own time and resources, through to management of small teams, to, you know, running a multi-hundreds of people, thousands of people organization. That's what that is. Leadership is about having people want to do that, and sometimes having them be a little bit skeptical and doing it anyway. It's about it, there are all sorts of people talk a lot about different leadership styles, and they talk about leadership styles of individuals. Sometimes I have found that you need to find a way to be true to yourself and adapt your leadership style to context. And that context can be different organizational context, or it could be where an organization sits in a, you know, for example, a very disruptive period of time or a not disruptive period of time. But the things that characterize quality leadership, in my mind, would be, if nothing else, people understand exactly where you are coming from, and they, to some extent, want to be there with you. And I can give you a really crisp, specific example of what that was like. And again, I'll pick an example from the pandemic, and I keep choosing that, but it's because it was a moment, a period of a couple of years where everything got heightened and everything got accelerated. And so it kind of stripped away a lot of the extraneous stuff. Crises tend to do that. And so I got to see with my boss what impelled his decision-making, and what impelled his decision-making was immediate instinctive concern for the well-being of our students and for our staff. And he just deployed the resources of the institution to that, figuring out the money and the business case came secondary to that. It was like that's what impelled him. And that was evident in his day-to-day decision-making behind closed doors. And it was evident in the way that he led the institution and deployed the resources to achieve particular outcomes. And those outcomes were first and foremost focused on the well-being of our people. And that's leadership, that's not management, because our resources could have been deployed in a gazillion different ways. And they would have been deployed effectively in a gazillion different ways, but the leadership was, this was somebody whose set of instinctive impulses we could get behind.
Absolutely. Can I just follow on from that for a second? We're talking about leadership through disruption, particularly, and we're all over the world. We're seeing technological disruption. We're seeing demographic disruption, social disruption. The list goes on and on and on for people. There is hardly a period of time when you can't easily point to some form of disruption happening in organizations. We're seeing many organisations folding up at the moment around Australia. We're seeing organisations going under across North America at the moment. And there is some indication that there's going to be a fair bit of pain over the next 12 to 18 months in a number of areas. From a leadership point of view, we've touched on the issue of, and you mentioned before, Eleanor, managing the why with your people, because you know if they can accept the why, then it's a little easier to accept the what, how, and when as well. I'm interested in getting into that culture and that people part for a couple of minutes. How have you found, what would you advise to our listeners around helping people through their fear, their anxiety, their own problems with their own stress as they go through this disruption that we are living through and will continue to live through in one form or another?
So my personal take would be that when we talk about these big disruptive forces that are going on at the moment, not just in the past but in the future, I listed them earlier, things like climate change, zoonotic diseases, mass urbanization, economic inequality, software's going to eat the world, rise of big tech and multinationals and all of that sort of stuff. We're all talking about it, and it feels like these things are so big that we have no agency about actually changing it. And for me, one of the things that I'm really consciously working on, both for myself, I kind of always instinctively did it, but one of the things that I'm consciously working on for myself, and when in my leadership capacity, I look to do this not just in the sort of the intimate leadership of the people who are immediately around me, but at scale as well, is actually to get really, really crisp about the idea of agency. So one of the definitions of agency is that it involves sensing the world, reasoning on the world, and then acting to change that so that it accords with your reasoning. So to give you a really specific example, you see a glass lying on its side on the table, you reason on that and decide that the glass should not be lying on its side on the table, and then you reach out and pick the glass up and put it the right way up. The problem that we've got at the moment when we talk about all of these major disruptive forces is that we don't feel like we've actually got the ability to, like, we can see what's going on, we can reason on it, reason about it, and say we don't think that's a great way to go. And it feels like you just don't have the ability to do the equivalent of pick the glass up and put it the right way around. Yeah. So the thing that I'm really consciously working on for myself and for other people is to focus on, well, so what do we have agency over? What can we do? How, where can we exert the kind of power necessary to affect change in the world? And the most interesting thing for me out of all of this is, in fact, that people talk a lot about STEM skills and stuff at the moment, and STEM ways, STEM careers, and thinking about that. And it's one way of understanding the world, is one way of reasoning on the world, but actually the kind of skills you need to change things at scale are not STEM skills, they're people skills. And so to give people books to read, things to think about, things to look at, it feels like they are actually having an impact on the world. They are doing their little bit of picking the glass up and turning it around. I have always found that to be, whenever I feel stuck, I have always found that to be an incredibly powerful way to kind of just fight my way out of that corner. And for individuals and at scale, that's what I'm really consciously trying to work on for a lot of people at the moment. It feels to me like generally speaking, as a populace, we feel like we are lacking agency. And I reckon that is a place to really focus on and concentrate at the moment. And if that's a leadership gift I can give people, then I will keep doing that.
Eleanor, I'm personally convinced, and Daryl is too, that we need to be teaching leadership skills right from an early age. In fact, as Daryl has experienced through many, many organisations across the world, there are many fine STEM-based organisations that are complete train wrecks when it comes to the issues of leadership and the impact that has on people and on the health of the organisation. So I totally hear you, and Daryl totally hears you on that. Let's turn the tables now. We've had a bit of doom and gloom in the conversation for the last little while. It's not all doom and gloom. One of the joys that I have on a regular basis is helping I help facilitate the INSEAD Advanced Management Program, that special part of it where C-suiters get to destroy their organisations in the face of disruption, but then they get to rebuild them, to go on the front foot, as we say in Australia, and use disruption to defend against attacks from the outside, and in fact to build strategies to strengthen and to go on the offensive and to win. Do you do that?
Absolutely. So oftentimes the consequence of disruption is actually not that a new world emerges so much as the new world comes at you faster. So actually things that were happening anyway accelerate. And so again, I guess to go all the way back to the beginning, my take would be that if you have done the thinking about the external landscape as well as your internal strengths and assets, and you have a good grasp of what that magic disruption can do, is it can allow you to choose to accelerate things that had kind of already been in your back pocket to start with. And so yeah, you can definitely do that. And to go back to something that I mentioned briefly earlier on, Brendan Sargent's idea about strategic imagination is a really, really powerful one. So one of the things that people mix up a little bit, the word strategy is overused, and it gets mixed up. A strategic imagination is being able to teleport yourself into a different future and imagine a different future. Strategy is then about how you actually make that real, right? So strategy is the art of combining the imagination with reality to make as much of your imagined world real as you possibly can. And in times of disruption, it sometimes allows you to do things like when the window gets shattered, you get to choose which of the pieces you're going to pick up and carry into the future. But those choices have to be governed by a strategic imagination, and you kind of need to be carrying that around with you as you go. So, you know, if I was to give anybody one nugget to carry out of this conversation, it would be have an imagination about what the future should be. And that will give you everything you need to start to formulate strategy. And the other piece you need is obviously a good understanding of the reality of the world around you. But if you don't have strategic imagination, you're going to be buffeted around by the disruptions, not surf them.
Really well said, Eleanor, really well said. You know, over the last period of time, we've heard you acknowledge really clearly that there is a lot of great literature out there on leadership and strategy and culture and people. And if you really want to practice leadership, and I like the way you talk about practicing leadership, it's like practicing anything if you want to get better and better at it. It's not something you go and do a quick course on and say, tick that box. It's constantly practiced. There is plenty of great models and theory and research and articles about it to draw on. And there's there's plenty of opportunities, I think, to grab with so much disruption around. This is where great leaders really find their way and emerge. And so I enjoyed the way you were able to capture that as well for our listeners.
Eleanor Huntington, thank you so much for the conversation that we've had, for the insights, the honest reflections, and for the advice to current and future leaders. It's been a privilege and it's been good fun talking to you. Thank you.
And Eleanor, from me and on behalf of all of our listeners, what a gift you have given to young leaders, to middle managers, to senior leaders. What a gift you've given them of the unedited, brutal truth of leadership and the reality of being able to pick it up and apply it and learn from it and make a difference, not only in people's lives, but, you know, for organisations, for the community and for the world that we live in. I have really appreciated your thoughts and your commentary today. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a tremendous pleasure.